Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM with Gillette. When we show our best side, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
Game on 2FM.
Thanks to Jenny Green for kicking off the weekend. It's Friday the 15th of May and this is Game On.
Coming up today, we talk to a man who's tackled Jonah Lomu and COVID-19.
That's Jürgen. But
we'll get new advice from the Chief Medical Officer on Friday as to when we should start that process of reopening the country and reopening the economy.
Our frontline hero is Antrim's Neil McManus, whose vital work is helping in the search for a vaccine.
And European football expert Mark Langdon gives us the bluffer's guide to the Bundesliga. Better get used to that. All that and much, much more between now and 7 o'clock. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Donegal, it is Friday and there is some news.
It's
Ruby
back.
Is going to be very happy because racing is set to resume under strict protocols and behind closed doors in Ireland on the 8th of June. We thought it was going to be the 29th of June, but after consulting with the government, they have managed to secure an earlier return. Chief Executive Brian Kavanagh we're going to hear from him later on in the show.
Super news. I think it's great. I think they showed before lockdown that they could do everything behind closed doors. Obviously, they've followed all the protocols. But like we're seeing with Germany, and we'll be chatting to Mark Langdon shortly, sport is back and it's good to see. Might have been Ruby's birthday yesterday, but everyone involved in horse racing got a present today with this type of news. And it'll be good to see it, Marie, won't it?
Yeah, now there is some mixed reaction because obviously there's still a lot of restrictions in place. We can't go and see our families for a while yet. Well, anyone that lives within or outside the 5 kilometre radius. So that's difficult. But look, it's an industry. Sport is coming back in some sort of a sense. So that has to be a little bit of progress. And once we start seeing things coming back, then, you know, all things going well. And as long as everyone's safe, then other things will hopefully come back as well.
I think we'd agree with it, though. And even hit the nail on the head there. It is an industry and like it's important for people for work and it's providing living. So when all small things like that, of course, if you look at it purely as sport, then of course there's concerns. But when you see what goes on and you know it's small villages and towns that rely on, you know, the horsing season going on.
And more important than all of that, Ruby will be happy.
Ruby will be happy. What about the poor old greyhounds, though? They didn't get left out as well. It's fine to have a jockey, but if you're a greyhound, the poor greyhounds didn't get cleared to come back on June 8th. They're still holding out for another while.
I think the greyhound horse racing debate might be one for another day, Donegal. Yeah. It is Friday and German football's coming back and we're all very excited about it. So just to get us in the mood for the weekend, we're going to hear from the one and only Jurgen Klopp.
The boys the most, because we created a group there where not only the boys but all the people at Melwood, because we have a really, really good relationship and we became friends over the last 4.5 years. And so we saw each other pretty often with Zoom, any other telcos and stuff like this, but it's still not the same. And going back to Melwood, just go there, do the things we usually do, that's something I really miss, to be honest.
I hear you bumped into Steven Gerrard, is that right, while you were out exercising in the park? What was that like?
Interesting, because 4.5 years I lived in the town and never met him. I knew where he lives, and obviously I live in the house he built, Brendan Rodgers bought, and we rent. but it never happened. And now, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 times I saw him for sure, walking with his kids and or with his missus. And so I'm on a run or on a dog walk. We always keep distance, yeah? So when it's easy, you can speak to another person when you are 5, 6 meters apart. So no, it's nice. I admired him as a player, then I met him here, and it's a great guy. So always good to see him.
It's been interesting to talk to lots of managers and players over the last few weeks. Lots have been learning new skills, doing a bit of homeschooling. Mikel Arteta has been enjoying that particularly. And you know, time to think about you know, life. Has the extra time that you have had given you the opportunity to reflect on your job, on your time at Liverpool, on what you're hoping to achieve at the club?
No, I am not a person like this. I don't sit back and think about my future or my past or something like that. Obviously, I saw a lot of videos of our games. I never had time for this in my entire life, so now I enjoy that. But I didn't learn a lot in the lockdown. Apart from that, obviously, Gary Neville has an opinion about absolutely everything.
You knew that before, though, didn't you?
it's incredible. So, didn't learn a lot, but I know myself since 52 years, and I knew I can deal with difficult situations before. And so this is a difficult situation, not only for me, not only for my family, for everybody on this planet. And so I'm quite proud how we as a society deal with it, to be honest. It's, again, we are, as human beings, not perfect, so we will always make mistakes, but I think we all understood a lot more how much we are connected to each other. And there are not a lot of good things in a moment, but that we learned that and we were allowed to learn that, I think that's something good.
That was Jurgen Klopp there speaking to our colleagues in the BBC. Donegh, I'm pretty happy that he hasn't learned a huge amount. You know, he's not really reflecting during this time. I mean, I like that. I haven't done a huge amount either.
Yeah, what was his thing? He learned how to tie his tie and make scrambled egg.
And the dishwasher.
But he did have a good dig off Gary Neville, which you always tend to enjoy. It seems to be happening around sport at the moment. You see Djokovic is having a bit of a dig, saying that, you know, he believes he can win the most Grand Slams. I think when people have been cocooned for a little while, you know, they just need to get out now for a bit.
Yeah, it's been funny though. I like little spats. I like the odd Twitter fight and people coming out and saying things about each other and then meeting on the field afterwards and sorting it out.
Definitely. The way even Klopp put it was playful enough to just, just get a bit of a reaction. But hopefully, now that we're kind of media side where they're all, oh, come on, Gary, bite back.
He will too, probably. And it'll be funny, no doubt. Now, Donegh, moving on to our first guest, and he is the director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory. Killian de Gascon, you are very, very welcome to Game On. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Marie. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great. We're thrilled that you're on because we have lots of questions to ask you, as you can imagine. So we've just heard that the phase one of easing of restrictions is to begin on Monday, and we're going to see some sport coming back along with that. We'll see tennis and golf. Do you think that this is going to pave the way now for more sport to come back?
So that's a really good question. I suppose it's a difficult one to answer. So this is the first phase. We've got 3 weeks now of seeing what happens. In essence, with all of these things, it's about balancing the risk. So the public health advice, thankfully, over the last few weeks, we've seen a lot of progress thanks to people in the community and society taking on board the stay-at-home recommendation and the physical distancing restrictions. And ultimately, we'll have to see now what happens. So, you know, moving into phase one is, we can't say that there's zero risk associated with it, but we believe it's low risk. And we'll watch and wait over the next 3 weeks to see what happens, and hopefully there won't be any resurgence of the virus in that time period.
We've been kind of going over and back and around in circles about a question, and that question is social distancing and sport, contact sport, can they ever be compatible, Killian?
So you're starting with easy questions. Thanks, William. It's obviously challenging, but ultimately it's about balancing the risk. So we know about, I suppose, the virus and disinfection. Your risk is associated with the number of contacts you have, the duration of the contact, the location of those contacts, whether it's indoors or outdoors, and then the nature of the contact, whether it's very sort of up close and personal or physically distant. So ultimately, the players in sports will reflect what's happening in the community from a virus perspective. So if there's very little virus circulating in the community, then we would hope to see an increase in sporting activity over the phases through the coming weeks and months. But obviously, if there's for example, if you go back maybe three or four weeks ago when we were having 500 or 600 cases a day, lots of virus circulating in the community, then in that situation, no, physical distancing and sort of close contact sport are not compatible because the risk is just too great. But as we've seen the numbers come down, and we would hope to see the numbers come down for more over the coming weeks. And that's why, I suppose, the testing element has been so high profile over the last few weeks. We've always been able to test in hospitals. We've always been able to test sick people.
We've always been able to test healthcare workers, but because of the challenges we had in scaling up the testing capacity, didn't have a huge amount of, I suppose, surveillance type or random testing in the community, if you like. So an awful lot of people who weren't in a vulnerable group or a risk group who may have had symptoms weren't able to get a test. So we still need to get a better handle on what's happening in the community, and we'll get that now with the increased capacity. And we're seeing it already. The positivity rate, thankfully, is still quite low in the community based on the data we have to date. But ultimately, what we're seeing within, you know, obviously our players come from communities and come from society. So if there's a lot of virus circulating, then the risk associated with sports is greater. Hopefully, if there's not a lot of virus circulating, then we can start to build up that the sporting competitions over the coming weeks and months.
So if there isn't a lot of virus circulating, but we don't have a vaccine, would you be able to recommend contact sport coming back just in that instance?
And I suppose probably something that there's a bit of confusion about, in the sense that we don't necessarily, I suppose, recommend what the government will do. We try to provide the public health advice and allow the government then to take into account all of the other considerations. But I think with a phased approach at the moment, I think we're looking at team sports probably around phase four, if everything goes according to plan. And after that, if we get to phase five and there's still not a lot of virus around, then contact sports do come back into the reckoning. So it's not a question of saying not ever. In essence, what we want to try and do is make sure that we, I suppose, give the appropriate advice based on the level of risk that we believe is there, based on circulating virus at a particular point in time. So all of our advice will be kept under review. And just because we've moved into phase one doesn't mean we stop looking at what's happening from the point of view of the virus, the number of cases, the number of hospitalizations, the number of people in intensive care, the number of people that unfortunately pass away as a result of this infection. All of that monitoring will continue, and probably even more closely now over the next 3 weeks. And the reason we've chosen 3 weeks is because that's an incubation period and a half, in essence. So that timeline is really important for us to see what impact these measures will have. We're not going to see, you know, if we got, just for argument's sake, if there was a massive spike over, you know, next Tuesday or Wednesday, that wouldn't be related to Monday, because the infection takes about typically, you know, 7 to 10 days before we see an effect. So we're really sort of looking over the measures that we put into place, or we start to lift on Monday. We'll be looking really at the middle week, if you like, to see if they have had any major impact on the amount of circulating virus in the community and the number of cases.
There is a narrative starting to emerge, I think, over the last few days, where certain people are saying that we're going to have to just learn to live with the virus, and, you know, if it's going to be there, that we're going to have to almost make a decision to exist with it. Do you think we're going to get to that stage ever?
Yeah, again, a really good question. There are two opportunities. Obviously, if we look at, say, somewhere like New Zealand, they've managed to practically eliminate the virus, which is a great achievement. They have some advantages given their location and the size of the country and the population, various other things. From our perspective, I think it's likely that the virus is going to be with us for quite a while. Obviously, a vaccine would be great, but there's no guarantee. So, and I think it's because of the fact that there's no guarantee about the vaccine that we probably need to look at alternative strategies. So, therefore, I think there will be an element of having to live with the virus. Obviously, we're looking at antiviral therapies as well, and that would probably be a safer option, or probably it's more likely to happen, I would think, in a shorter time frame than the vaccine approach. If we were told, you know, in 12 months' time, you'll definitely have a vaccine that will work and it will be very effective, then people might actually be willing to tolerate the measures or the restriction measures for a longer period of time. But I think when we can't give people a definitive date, I think we need to look at, I suppose, strategies of living with the virus until that happens. But there's also a possibility, and I say this sort of very guardedly, there's also a possibility that the virus, you know, the illness associated with it may become less severe over a course of time, purely because we've seen that, you know, it's a new virus to us as a human host. It's adapting to us. So we don't know what's going to happen over the coming years with that virus. Like, we have other human coronaviruses that cause the common cold. They would have transferred from animal species as well, probably hundreds of years ago. We don't know exactly when, but they're obviously mild now. So we don't know what happened with them originally. Were they more severe or were they always mild? So there's still a lot of unknowns, but I think we do have to err on the side of caution. And obviously this virus can cause severe disease in a significant amount of people. So I think we do have to be cautious for as long as we can, and just hope that with a vaccine or an antiviral therapy will come along fairly soon.
Killian, you say you think it's going to be with us for quite a while. Like, how long is that? do you think?
Well, I think it's is it going to be, as I said, we have 4 human coronaviruses at the moment that cause common cold. So is it going to be like one of those? And ultimately, unless we can get a vaccine, like the virus has shown a capacity to be very transmissible. So ultimately, what the virus wants to do is transmit from person to person. It's not going to, you know, if it lands on a table or if it lands on the ground, it will die. It's not going to cause any problems there. So it needs a host and it needs to transmit from person to person. So ultimately, the way our lifestyle involves, you know, a social sort of interaction and work and public transport and all the rest of it, it's an ideal environment for the virus to live. So I think there's no obvious reason at this point in time why the virus would suddenly cease to live with us. As I said, if we get a vaccine, we can potentially get to a stage where everybody is immune, and then the vaccine, then the virus doesn't have enough people in essence. It doesn't have a susceptible population to infect. But if we look at the numbers of cases at the moment, and we look at, so that we've got in Ireland, which is probably just over somewhere around 22 or 23,000, I think, just at the moment. But say, even if we're just, if we're missing cases, just for example, just for argument's sake, so we're about 23,000 at the moment. Say we're missing 90% of cases and maybe 250,000 people have been infected in the country. That still leaves in the region of just over 90% of the population that are still susceptible. So that's why we have to be so cautious with the lifting any restriction measures in the coming weeks, because we believe that there's still a huge amount of people out there who are susceptible and have not been infected. So the seroprevalence or the antibody studies that people are talking about, we would hope to start those in probably next month, sometime in June. They will give us additional information, because they will tell us, there will obviously have been people who had a very mild illness or maybe had no symptoms at all. There will be people out there who have been infected and don't know it. And what we're trying to figure out then with the seroprevalence studies is what percentage of the population that has happened to. So, for example, it could be 5%. It would be great if it were 20%. It would be fantastic if it were 40%. We don't really believe it will be that high. We think it'll probably be somewhere in the region of maybe 5 to 10%, but we really don't know. But that information will be very important for informing our strategies in the coming months as well.
So just from a sport point of view then, like if you were to look at that, like what percentages would you need to be hitting to think, okay, sport could start to form, a contact sport could start to form some part of the roadmap coming back?
Well, so it's in phase five of the roadmap at the moment. And to be fair, if you look at, say, the World Rugby document, I think that's very sensible. I think things will have to be done slightly differently. And I think what I suppose one of the things that sort of NPHET and the government have tried to do is to give people the roadmap so that they can start planning and start looking at different ways of doing things. Like there's a huge amount of very bright people working in rugby and various other sports trying to figure out how they can change things. So whether that's symptom screening when people arrive for training, whether it's sort of small group training, whether it's taking temperatures, whether it's doing sort of testing players, but ultimately it will depend on what's happening in the community. So if we can get to a very low level of virus in the community, then it's possible that, you know, there's no reason that sort of team sports can't return and be part of society. But the reason we just have to move slowly is because, for example, if we lift restrictions, as I said, on Monday, if in 3 weeks' time we see a resurgence of virus, then obviously the timing isn't right. But if we can get through, you know, say small group training and then maybe larger groups sort of training but with no matches, if all of those things happen and we don't see an effect, we don't see an increase in the amount of virus, then that's ultimately what we're looking at. Like, for example, it's in some respects it's not rocket science. The public health advice that we're trying to give is very much based on the hard figures that the CMO is presenting every day. It's the number of cases, It's the number of hospitalizations, and it's the number of people in intensive care, and the number of deaths there. They're the measures, and obviously people will be familiar with the or not as well. So we know that that the community and the society has managed to drive the or not down to probably about 0.5, which is great. And if that can be sustained, then the epidemic in essence should sort of phase out over time. But it's just, we just have seen what can happen in our own country, in our nursing homes, and now in some of the meat processing plants. So we do know that given the right set of circumstances, the virus can cause significant harm, and it's not difficult to imagine that in the likes of, say, you know, a gym or a sports club. So if you can see, as sports will return, people will be maybe changing at home, showering at home, that type of thing. So you can be outdoors, you can do your training, but what we don't want is the congregating around the clubhouse. And that's probably the hardest part, because it's often the most social element of sport. But ultimately, the public health advice will depend on just what's happening in the community and how much virus is circulating. And as I said, if we can keep the virus at a very low level, then there's, as I said, it's a risk-benefit. There's an appetite to increase risk. Nothing, you know, any measure we lift will increase risk to a certain degree. We can't say there's no risk associated with it, but obviously there's a downside to prolonged restrictions as well, from a, you know, social isolation perspective, a mental health perspective. So we are cognizant of all of those things. And now that we have a little bit of control over the virus, we can start releasing the pressure, hopefully a little bit, but just make sure that we don't release it too quickly so that the virus can't come back at us very quickly.
Last Sunday on the Sunday game, John Horan said that he doesn't see Gaelic games coming back while social distancing measures are in place. Just like from a, with your professional hat on, what was your interpretation of that?
I have to say, I suppose I was quite impressed, because again, a certainty is really important, I think, for people, and the uncertainty is often quite difficult. And I think, you know, there are two different elements. Obviously, GA is an amateur profession, and we can talk about potential solutions such as, you know, games behind closed doors, but obviously that's a risk to the players. So I think we need to be careful about that. And those players will go home then to their families. They'll go home to maybe their elderly parents or grandparents. So we can't sort of put them in a, you know, lock them up in a hotel for the season just to entertain the rest of us. So I think it's important to get the balance right. So I think John Horan made a good decision from a personal perspective. I think he made a good decision. He looked at what was there. He looked at the roadmap and said, well, realistically, this is where we're going. And if things are great, you know, a couple of months sooner, he has the opportunity. There is an opportunity there to maybe bring things forward. But at least he's given some certainty. And as I said, I think in the amateur sports, it's really important that so these guys are coming from our community, and girls, they're not being paid. So I think it's we need to be careful about necessarily potentially pushing for them playing games for our entertainment behind closed doors. Because, as I said, hopefully there may be a very low risk, but as I said, it's not going to be no risk. So we do need to be careful about how we move through the phases.
Killian, there's a lot of questions coming in, and one of them is, actually a few of them are around kids and summer camps, and whether we will see this year our kids returning to playing sports together, and whether that's with their teams or summer camps. Is that something you could see?
I think it's looking at the roadmap as it's laid out at the moment, from the point of view of schools and team sports, I think it's probably difficult. I suppose we're like phase four, I think, is where we are from the point of view of team leagues and sports, and obviously the government has talked about schools opening up in September. So it's probably challenging looking at it from this far out. But again, I suppose I wouldn't want to be predicting anything or definitively excluding anything, because ultimately it will all, like I said, the public health advice will be kept updated, and at each point. You know, obviously the next date that people will be looking at now is June 8th, and that's really, we're not looking any further past that at this point in time. The key thing is see what happens after we release restrictions, move into phase one on May 18th, and then go from there. But everything is kept under review. The framework document, you know, isn't necessarily set in stone. There are opportunities there to potentially move individual things depending on on what's happening with the virus at the time. But I suppose at this point, the way it's laid out, it's probably not something that is a certainty, at least, if you like.
Killian, you've obviously had tough battles before. This isn't your first one. You've taken on Jonah Lomu, which isn't the easiest task for anyone that's been involved in World Rugby.
Well, yeah, no, thankfully, back in my day, he was still a forward, so I didn't really have to tackle him that much.
Yeah. But you played a bit with Trinity, you played a bit with Turnior, like Marie yourselves, just personally, you must be missing sport.
Yeah, although I have to be honest, I haven't played a lot of team sport in a few years. But yeah, no, I think we are conscious of the fact that it is very difficult for people because of such a social element. And actually, it's funny, that's probably the part of team sport that I miss the most is, you know, is the changing room afterwards and, you know, the clubhouse sort of on a Tuesday or Thursday night, whatever it was, or the bus back from a match down the country somewhere, you know. So that social element is really important to society in Ireland. And we're keen, obviously, just even as individuals, to try and get back to that point as soon as possible. But it's just that we really have to just err on the side of caution because, as I said, we've seen what the virus can do. So it's just really important to go slow and steady, because the last thing people want to be doing is sort of, you know, one step forward and then two steps back. So I think it'll be I think the phased approach is the right one. But we do appreciate how difficult it is for people, especially when it's not the same for everybody, because obviously, you know, people in individual sports will be able to get back. And obviously you were talking earlier on there about horse racing. So it's unfortunate that it won't be a single rule for everyone or a one size fits all approach. It will be staggered over the coming months.
And we have seen what the virus can do, but just all the inter-county managers, the coaches we've been speaking to over the last few weeks, they all make the point about mental health. These young men, young women, that, you know, they're used to whatever about the kind of the sport itself, but the socialising part of it, like you mentioned, the importance of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's across the board. It's not just the sport element. It's obviously, the population that has been cocooning is... there are mental health implications for that, and we do try to take that on board. I suppose the priority for us, say, over the last 6 weeks has been just trying to get some semblance of control over the virus and get a good picture, an accurate picture of what was happening with it in the country. And now that we have that, we can start to feed in all of the other considerations, so the mental health considerations, the economic considerations, and all of those elements. And we want to, I suppose, get people out as soon as is safe to do so. And as I said, hopefully we have made progress to date. And I think if people can hold firm, but you're right, I think the increase to sort of people now meeting in groups of four that's been announced, I think that's the first step. And as I said, if people can do that and do it safely, then in phase two, there will be sort of a return to sort of small group training, and that I think will be really important. It's obviously very challenging for people, and we are aware of that. But it's so important when we've seen what happens with this virus, given the right set of circumstances, and you know, the fact is, as Marie was saying, the fact that we don't have a vaccine, the fact that we don't have antiviral therapies, we just really can't take any risks. But you're right, I think like the mental health implications of this are certainly something that we will be. We will have to address over the coming months as well.
Killian, there are talks of perhaps an Interpro series being played in the Viva Stadium or even a League of Ireland mini tournament. The talks are that it could be on July 20th. Do you think that would be too soon?
I suppose that, again, I don't necessarily want to be sort of predicting or sort of including or excluding anything. It depends, I suppose, on what is happening in the community at the time and ultimately what. Because again, what sort of size crowd or group you'd be talking about? Because we have, you know, July 20th, I think, will be the start of phase four, if I have my dates right. And at that stage, we do have in the framework document of the reopening plan, there's sports sort of and team leagues are included in that phase. So it's something that we sort of are working towards. And if it's safe to do so, again, there will be a risk. benefit analysis that will have to be carried out at the time. And ultimately, it may be slightly different in the sense of how people, you know, how players would travel, or, you know, whether the what the facilities would be like. And again, having the framework document there for people to work towards does give them time to plan how things will work, because obviously physical, you know, social distancing is still going to be with us in July, certainly, and in August. So there will have to be, I suppose, measures taken into account in the context of sort of stadia and of changing rooms, and even sort of simple things like travelling to matches or travelling to stadia. So it's not something, as I said, it's certainly not something that I would definitively be excluded at this point in time, and hopefully we'll be in a position where it can happen at the stage. But again, given the fact that it's so far out, where it would be silly to try and predict exactly what will be happening on July 20th. But if people can sort of stay the course with us and continue the physical distancing measures, the hand hygiene, the respiratory etiquette, all of those basic factors, because that's all we really have to control the virus at this point in time. As I said, the priority for us now over the next 3 weeks is to see what happens when we start to lift restrictions, and hopefully we'll be able to move through the phases in a straightforward fashion.
When somebody paints a picture for you, I think it gets quite sobering. And Kingston Mills, the professor of experimental immunology, did so with Dino Reardon in The Times during the week. He said, take, for example, the front rows in a scrum. If one of those has the virus, the whole scrum is going to have it. It's kind of hard to see past that, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And again, I suppose that's sort of a very vivid picture for people. But if you're at a stage where, so again, if you were, say you've two rugby squads plus your referee, your linesman, your coaches, whatever, I guess that's probably in the region of maybe, what is it, 50 or 60 or something in a stadium, just for argument's sake. And assuming the challenge is, I suppose, amateur versus professional, but assume it's professional. They can, in the week up to the match, they can be screening for symptoms, they can be screening, they can do temperature screening, they can ensure that the players aren't necessarily interacting with other groups. So in essence, you're just trying to control the risk associated with it, so that if there is somebody who's infected, at least it's limited to sort of a confined group. But if we get to that stage where there's still very little virus circulating in the community, then the risk of being in a crowd of 60 is quite low. As I said sort of earlier, if you go back 4 or 5 weeks, the risk of being in a crowd of 60 with the virus circulating would have been significantly higher. But we know now that because people have stayed at home, the virus hasn't been circulating as much in the community. Unfortunately, obviously, we've seen it in nursing homes and in other centres. But the risk of, as I said, bringing people together in that time period, if we're a few months down the track and there's very little virus circulating, then the risk is potentially lower, because, as I said, ultimately, the risk relates to, you know, the number of contact, the duration of contact, but the big factor is how much virus is circulating. So is that the reason we restricted gatherings a number of weeks back was because we felt the virus was circulating in the community and it was too risky to have large numbers of people coming together in very close contact. Obviously, we're starting to come out the other side of that now, and the numbers involved will build up slowly. We want to build them up slowly because we still, as I said, we're not 100% certain how much virus is circulating in the community, so the testing will inform that strategy, the seroprevalence will inform that strategy. But then if there's very little virus circulating, we can increase the size of the group without necessarily increasing the risk significantly to the individual. And that's what it comes down to. It's about the number of people with whom you have contact.
And just on another report that was in the paper Miguel Delaney had today, he was saying that Stats Boards, who provide all the GPS to the Premier League, have done a study, and that close contact incursions only last 3.3 seconds in football matches, and that it's almost impossible then to contract the virus. What do you think?
Yes, yeah, we define close contact as greater than 15 minutes face-to-face, or say a group of people in the same room for more than 2 hours. So casual contact, we know your risk is quite low, sort of passing somebody in the street or something like that. But equally, we know it's not a zero risk. So, for example, the problem with, or one of the challenges with the sports environment, is that it's obviously quite different because people are panting, they're exhaling, they're exerting themselves, they're breathing more heavily. And I suppose what we didn't realise, perhaps from the outbreak in China at the start of the year, we're learning more now about, I suppose, asymptomatic transmission and pre-symptomatic transmission. We're learning, learning more about the size of the droplets and that can cause transmission. So if you're in close contact with somebody, is that it's not only just, I suppose, the number and the duration of the contact, you also have to factor in the what happens during that contact and whether it's, you know, if you're exerting yourself, and that probably does increase the risk. So obviously time is a factor there, but it's also related to what's happening during that time. And as I said, if people are exerting themselves, they're going to be breathing heavily, it's likely that if they were infected that they would be shedding more virus, if you like, than they would be if they were sort of sitting at home watching television or something like that.
Killian, I think you nailed it there when you said we're learning, because I definitely feel like I've learned more in the last few months about this virus or any virus than I have before. Look, we really appreciate you taking the call. Killian de Gascoigne, we'll be following your work now and hopefully we'll have some answers. But one thing that's for sure is that we'll definitely be talking about this for the weeks to come.
Exactly. Listen, thanks, Bo. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Thanks. Game on 2FM. Now it is time to move on to our Friday frontline hero. This week it's Antrim's Neil McManus, who is working for a technology firm who are playing their part in helping find the COVID-19 vaccine. Neil, you're very welcome to the show. How are things?
Very well, Marie. Thanks for having me.
So explain to us exactly what you do and how you're going to save us all.
we have it, so no. I work for a company called Andor Technology in Belfast, and we make scientific cameras, amongst other things. And these are used for two different things, really. One is astronomy, mainly, which we would call physical sciences, trying to find things like new stars, new planets, galaxies, that type of thing. And then the other side of the business is what we would call life sciences. And this is the bit that is really applicable to COVID-19 and where we all are at the minute. So many of our customers working in this area are using the instruments that we build in Belfast to hopefully find a vaccine, do tests, interrogate cells, and that type of thing.
And Neil, on that, how has the life science side of the business changed since before COVID?
It has grown. The customers that we have, the medical companies and a lot of universities and test laboratories around the world, actually, most of our product is sold outside of Europe. They have obviously started to ramp up in many areas because there's such a need with the pandemic that's facing us. So it's become much busier, and you know, a lot of our staff probably 60-70% are working from home, and it's the production staff, the operation staff who are in the building only. And you know, because of the social distancing and the need to keep people apart, it's a challenge at the moment.
How has your life changed then?
it's kind of my life has changed from spending every evening doing something GA related, you know, going to hurling training or maybe going to a prize given some evenings or things like that, to spending more time in work. I've probably never been busier. I'm kind of looking after the operation side of things in the building at the moment. So we've moved the operation on the two shifts, so the building is open from 6 in the morning to almost 11 at night now. So it's a very busy time for me in a work scene, but I suppose that time would have been put in the GA otherwise.
And just on that, like we don't know where we'll get back to action. Obviously, work has stepped up for you, but your training probably has maintained the same level. How are you finding that?
The training hasn't probably. I'd say I'm not training just as much as I was, but I'm still training, trying to get probably 3 to 4 sessions in per week. And you know, it's actually more flexible. Sometimes I get up really early in the morning and do a gym session in my garden. I think like 90% of the inter-county players, there's been some sort of gym construction that's happened in a spare room or in a garage like myself. So that's really useful. And then whenever we're, you know, we're training, you know, you're maybe doing it on Zoom with some friends and things like that, you know, we can do it at a time that, that suits us all. So it's become more flexible, definitely, and there's a positive to that, no doubt about it. You know, even though I'm working longer hours, I'm at home more now, because rather than leaving work at 6 p.m. as it would have been, and going to another area in Belfast for training and heading back down into the Glens of Antrim, you know, which is an hour north of Belfast, probably getting home around 11 p.m. at night now. Even if I do work from early to late, I'm still going to be home for 7 or 8 o'clock. So it's good in that, you know, looking from that point of view. So I think there are definitely positives in it for me and for some people, even though, you know, there's very many people going through a really, really tough time.
So what are the people in Cushendall talking about when there's no GAA on?
Normal people.
And they're, you know, but it's, you know, for Cushendall, you know, like I'm sitting here in the living room, and this area, as you probably know, we're about 20 miles from Scotland, looking out onto Scotland here now, and the people here, you know, just GAA consumes the lives of probably 80% of the people in this village. And when you're out to run or you're out for a walk in the evenings, just you keep on getting asked the same question: when are we going back? Is there any chance of a match? You know, these type of things, because people can't wait for it to start. But I think we all understand that that's, and even after listening to Killian, even more so, we realise that, you know, this isn't going to be a quick fix. It's 2 to 3 months away, which is unfortunate. But our community, anyway, we're blessed with the coastal walks and the kind of rural nature of this environment, because, you know, there's people out rowing boats, there's people walking up mountains, and it's very easy to stay socially distanced from people whilst, you know, being able to get out into the open air, which isn't the case for a lot of people, I'm sure, in the larger cities across Ireland.
Do you feel that's given you a bit of perspective on the importance of the GAA, the importance of what you do when you go out on a Saturday? Will you go back with a different view on, you know, the community behind you? I knew you knew it beforehand, but for me, when I stepped away from rugby, it isn't until you're kind of away a bit that you learn how important it is.
Totally. You know, I think, you know, and probably from my point of view here in Cushendall, you probably don't realise the effect that as a group, that your, you know, flagship team, which is the same as your senior hurling team in Cushendall here, have on the community. When the team seems to be going well, the spirit throughout the community is at a very high point. And, you know, even I live beside my father here, mother and father next door. I was out hitting the ball off the wall for an hour last week at one point, and my father just sat and watched. You know, he'd be delighted for a Junior B game. You know, that's the stage that he's at. But it's no difference. Like, for your family, it's probably the same. Rugby meant so much to them. And whenever you went on to do so well in your career, you know, how proud that made not only your own family, but the friends and the people you live with in your community.
Neil, years ago when Fela was on in Clare, we were twinned, my village, Sixmile Bridge, were twinned with Cushendall. I must see if I can find out some old photos and see who came down. I can't even remember the year, but I must check it out. But I know how much the GAA means to everybody up there, and as it does to most people around the country. So hopefully when it's safe, we'll see it back, and we'll be back talking about the on-field action again.
Totally. You know, and those are brilliant little nuances of the GAA. We still have some great connections with Middleton and Cork from the Fela as well, and, you know, yourselves, there's always a great tradition with my wife's club between Sixmile Bridge and Dunloy, who are about 25 minutes from here. I met in a club final in the 90s, and Davy Fitz was regularly up in this area too, and Niall Gilligan as well.
Of course, yeah. I'm pretty sure we won that one, 96, wasn't it?
96,
yeah. Here she goes. Yeah, unfortunately, Dunloy are a club known as kind of the best team not to have won in All-Ireland. I think they maybe lost 4 finals in the 90s.
Oh, that's a terrible title. Look, Neil, thanks so much, and we'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks.
Game on 2FM.
It's time for German football, Danica.
Is that what that was?
Surprise!
There you go. Okay, all sporting eyes will be on Germany this weekend as the Bundesliga returns with a potential billion viewers from around the globe. Mark Langdon from the Racing Post joins us. Mark, fanatical football fans aside, every sports person will watch this. It's now the barometer and the reference point for all sports, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot riding on this set of fixtures that goes far beyond just the return of the Bundesliga. You're absolutely right that, you know, particularly contact sports and team sports will be looking what they've done with quarantine, how they've got teams, you know, from the hotel to the stadium, how they get them out of there. You know, I suppose as well, the reaction from the players during the game, you know, is anybody going to be nervous to get involved in a tackle? How it plays out on TV in front of no crowd, whether the appetite is there to play again. There's so many sort of aspects to this game and sort of games than sort of ordinarily. And even though we're talking now about all of that, there's actually a massive game as well in the Bundesliga. Usually Dortmund versus Schalke is the biggest draw, really, in terms of like local derbies in German football. And yet it feels almost like an experiment, really, to just see how it goes. But the simple fact is, if the Germans can't get this sort of football back up and running, then the rest of Europe's got absolutely no chance.
And Mark, just on that, there's a tight time frame for it. June the 30th, it wraps up. So 9 intense weeks. And you're right, there's some critical games from tomorrow on.
Yeah, I mean, the way they've done the sort of schedule that they've announced the first three set of fixtures, and it's absolutely packed almost, on the daily coverage, in terms of TV, which, is what's needed. And you've got the second division as well that's playing, and they play at different times on the same days, but on different times to the, top flight teams, again, all for TV. And this is really the crux of why the Germans were so keen to come back. They've not received all of the TV money. They won't get the final payments until the season is finished. There are fears that between a half and a third, it'll be in the region of those two figures, we will see teams go bust if they don't finish the campaign. We've already had one team, Dynamo Dresden, suffer with three players that have tested positive, or three staff members tested positive in recent days. So their game has been called off. But they're hopeful that, you know, if there is the odd positive test, that they will just be able to isolate that person, test everybody, and keep this show on the road. There's a real desperation to make sure the season is finished, and they've brought in the 5 substitute rule that has recently been allowed, just so that you know, this packed fixture schedule can be completed, and completed before the contracts run out at the end of June.
And just from a pure entertainment point of view as well, like, there's a lot of good teams there. And when you look at the top three sides, Bayern, Dortmund and Leipzig, they're among the top scoring teams in Europe. So it should be entertaining.
Oh, it absolutely will be. No doubt about that. Leipzig, I think anybody that watched their game against Tottenham in the Champions League will have seen the kind of positive football that they play under their young manager, Julian Nagelsmann. Timo Werner, their striker, one of the most highly sort of sought after players, really, in Europe at the moment. Jadon Sancho has just been phenomenal for Borussia Dortmund. They've got a few injuries. Marco Reus is not playing in the game, and nor is Emre Can against Schalke, but still got Erling Braut Haaland, who's made an astonishing start to his life with the Bundesliga club. And even a little bit further down, somebody like Bayer Leverkusen in fifth, they beat Rangers recently in the Europa League. Kai Havertz is people are calling him the new Michael Ballack, which is a difficult sort of label and tag to carry around with you, but there's no doubt that He will leave Leverkusen in the summer for a lot of money. Obviously, transfers will be impacted by the coronavirus pandemic and what clubs can spend, but I'm still pretty sure he will command a huge fee. He's a player of immense talent, and I think in terms of the Bundesliga, those that don't usually watch it and are tuning in for the first time, you'll see, even without the crowds, I think the tempo of the games will be high. Most of the teams sort of adopt that Jurgen Klopp style sort of pressing mentality to win the ball back. They defend high, they try to score a lot of goals, so it should be fun. There is obviously that little caveat that, you know, we're not used to these what they're calling ghost games, and whether the crowd will have a big effect on the style of football and the entertainment value, but hopefully not.
Who are you going to be supporting?
Well, I mean, this is a tricky one. I always think, though, Borussia Dortmund are the ones to follow. And for any listeners that have never been to watch a Bundesliga game, if there's one team to really sort of go and see, it's definitely Borussia Dortmund. Signal Iduna Park is the most atmospheric stadium, you know, probably in European football. And, you know, once people are allowed to start travelling again, you should put it on the bucket list. It's an amazing place, and I'll probably be cheering them on. And also, that a lot of people like Union Berlin, the second team in Berlin, they came up in the summer, very much seen as like a socialist club, and, you know, with left wing views. And
Mark,
you know,
I'm going to have to cut you off now because it is time to go, and I think I'm safe to say we could be talking about German football all night, but that is all we have time for.
Game on 2FM.